Hello. Our bodies need fuel, and what kind of food we ingest affects our physical and mental health. Food that reminds us of our family and traditions can be more satisfying and promote well-being. What happens when we eat food that is highly processed and shipped to stores and restaurants from thousands of miles away compared to eating fresh local food? How does choosing where your food comes from affect the local economy? Our guest today will help us explore the benefits of healthy eating for ourselves and our families and helping local food suppliers. I'm Lori Townsend. I'm filling in as host for Line One, not as a doctor, but as a journalist and as someone who loves to grow food and harvest wild plants and appreciates what it takes to keep local farmers in business. Stay with us as we explore food security and healthy living. My guests today are Tara Lloyd. Tara is the Executive Director of the Alaska Farmers Market Association and so much more. And also in the studio with us is Amy Foote. Amy is the Director of Indigenous Cuisine and the Executive Chef for NANA Management Services, also wearing other hats that we'll find out more about soon. Welcome, both of you. Thanks so much for being with us. To me, seeing food as medicine is just a recognition that how we feed ourselves and our families has huge effects on physical and mental health. Nutrient-dense food can promote healing and longevity. Junk food can contribute to disease and premature death. So yes, food is medicine. But please, I want both of you to give us your takes on this and what you've seen in your professional lives to support that. Tara, you have an amazing background in a wide range of health-related work, from building healthcare systems in Malawi to housing safety for children orphaned by AIDS in Southern Africa to now overseeing the state's Farmers Market Association. Put all this background together for us, and is there a through line here that points to food?
Well, thanks, Lori. Yes, I think that you opened with that through line, that it's sort of the basis of all of our connections, our health, our ties to community, our cultural identity. I'm from Eastern Kentucky, and I grew up in a family that farmed, and I was sort of desperate to get out, which took me to the Peace Corps and then to Southern Africa. And I spent my 20s and 30s involved in work, as you said, there, primarily supporting healthcare systems. But food was always an underlying aspect, of course, in a place where food insecurity is so palpable, where there's a hungry season, a famine season, where, you know, people might come in for healthcare. We supported the public health system, so it was never a standalone healthcare endeavor. It was supporting the government facilities. Some people would come in with a chronic disease or perhaps something acute, and it really couldn't be treated without nutrition as an underlying basis, so much malnourishment. And so I used to think of it from that perspective, and then I began to understand more deeply that the ties and connections people have to the types of foods they eat. And, you know, you might get re-nourished with a peanut butter powder if you were a child in rural Malawi, but that wasn't the same thing as getting to eat the things that your grandmother prepared. And I think I thought a lot about it as I went to public health school and focused on health care. But then coming back to Alaska, this is my second time having the chance to live here. I worked for Rural Cap many years ago for a couple of years and spent a lot of time in the rural villages. Saw sort of up close and personal what the food system looks like there, the AC stores, the price of produce, traditional food patterns changing as climate change affects things. And that stuck with me. But then the second time around, my husband and family and I live here in Alaska, and it was such a delight to get this job because food is medicine is the through line for me, that the idea that public health is sort of anchored in what we're able to feed ourselves and our families and who supports that. And then just the idea that not everyone has access. And so working a lot on the question of equity and how to make sure that, like, people are able to make that choice. And so we can talk about that more later. But I didn't really know that food is medicine was, like, a coined and active term in the world. I just thought, like, oh, yeah, this job makes sense because food is medicine. So it's public health. So it's, you know, on the career path of life, it makes sense that I want to be out of the farmers markets. But then I've since joined a coalition that I'm excited to talk about that's a statewide effort run by the Food Bank of Alaska that really brought food as medicine together and represents decades of their work to elevate the kinds of things I'm talking about.
I kind of like that expression just because I like the idea of kind of people reframing how they look at food. You know? It's kind of one of those things that you just eat a meal and you don't think about what's going on, but especially teaching younger people that making those selections really matters
choosing junk food over an apple really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk more about that. But Amy, please, this is right in your wheelhouse for sure. You're mm-hmm. on the governing board of the Alaska Food Policy Council. You're also a chef for the World Central Kitchen. You used to lead the traditional food program at the Alaska Native Medical Center, and now you're at NANA. Tell us why supporting Indigenous food systems and access is important to you and what you've observed about the benefits of cultural comfort food.
Wow, so I'm not sure how to answer, I guess, kind of your full question, but I would say that my passion for what I do is has kind of come over the years for a long, long time. Worked in healthcare, started off as a chef. I was kind of interested when you were saying, Tara, that it really marries itself together with the work that you do. The work I'm doing now is really focused on supporting kind of our state in a wide variety of ways, and supporting, you know, schools and healthcare and long-term care and, even camps, you know, that kind of work. So food systems are a big part of what I guess my passion is. Looking at what I've seen over the years in Alaska, I came up I think we moved back up in 2014 and was able to work at ANMC and establish the traditional foods program there and just kind of continue to help others start. NANA, we have our own traditional foods program that supports a lot of our accounts as well. And so what I've been able to see throughout that and really just learning for me, it's been, I think, a lesson kind of along the way, whether it's meeting with elders, again, going into rural healthcare or going out into rural settings and just learning the way of life and establishing that has been that it is so important having access to foods that are available to us on the land and on the sea and that are part of what we do here in Alaska. I just went fishing a couple weeks ago to fill up the freezer. So, getting our halibut and our rockfish so we have that for the season and moving aside as I'm reorganizing my freezer to make sure the moose, you know, that we're still carrying over from last fall. Spent some time planting potatoes out the Matanuska Experimental Farm and Extension Center on Monday. It was gorgeous weather, I'll tell you.
I planted potatoes last weekend.
Perfect. And so those are an heirloom variety of potato that we plant out there. We plant a Tlingit and Haida potato patch kind of out there and grow them every year. And those are benefiting the Pioneer Homes. Mm. And so it was really great to, again, you know, it's planting, it's harvesting what we can wild, it's just seeing that time out on the land, you know, watching everybody kind of get some sun since the last couple of days have been really nice weather, to just interacting with our surroundings in a way that we love and appreciate that. And that all is as part of healing. The act of us being able to plant and harvest something like the potatoes and be able to gift those to elders within our community. That's another interaction that really provides love and care and respect and a reciprocal relationship within our community. And so all those things really, I think, all tie together.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'm so happy to get us started off this way, and we'll drill down on a lot of these points. If you're just joining us, this is Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Lori Townsend, filling in as guest host today, and we're talking about food as medicine. In the studio, Tara Lloyd is the executive director of the Alaska Farmers Market Association, and Amy Foote is the director of Indigenous Cuisine and an executive chef for NANA Management Services. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Nicole is in Eagle River. Hello, Nicole.
Hey there. Hey, just a terrific topic. And I just want to speak out for good, clean, I call it good, clean living. I was raised by two old hippies. And we, in Michigan, and we harvested everything, grew everything from scratch, from bread to pasta to pasta sauce, everything made from scratch. And I carried that on. I'm 46 now. And I have no major health issues, no chronic illness. And I kind of chalk it up to good, clean, healthy. Do I enjoy the occasional, like, processed food? Sure. But I pretty much eat what I can make myself. And another thing that amazes me is that 3 years ago, my dear husband was diagnosed with ultra-high-risk multiple myeloma. And along with that, he had kidney failure. and they sent him home and crossed their fingers, and we're going to check him again in a couple of weeks and get him started on dialysis. But a friend gave us goldenrod tea, and he drank the heck out of it. And when he went back, his creatine, or creatinine, I never remember what it's called, went from 11.8 to 1.2. And the nephrologist said he'd never seen anything like it. And it's I chalk it up to good, clean living and just the food is medicine. That's pretty much all I can say. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you, Nicole. What a wonderful story. So happy for your husband. And hopefully that's going okay. And it's great to hear that you had a life of being raised by folks who understood the value in growing food and the joy in creating your own ingredients and making things. There's a lot to that. So thank you for the call. Are either one of you, Tara or Amy, studying why the food of one's culture is so effective at creating feelings of well-being and promoting health? Do you think is it just nostalgia, or is it more than that?
I could speak to that. I think not officially, right? There's not a lot of studies that have come out even on indigenous or traditional foods, or kind of looking at that culturally appropriate food along the way. But I would say that being in a healthcare type setting in the last 20 years, I say that and I say, wow, it's really been that long. And it really has. But being able to watch, kind of along the way in seeing folks, whether they've been in long-term care. I know recently we had someone that, you know, had been, you know, in one of the homes for a long time and was kind of declining, you know, that which, you know, sometimes happens, and really like weight loss related. And we introduced all the time traditional foods offering where it was kind of on demand. And we saw that specific person gain like 10 pounds in 2 months, which brought them from this decline up to, right, a thriving situation. And for just one person, you know, that's what, and I can tell you, you know, hundreds of stories that are similar to that in being through healthcare or in the long-term care. So I don't have, I guess, specific study, but again, watching the difference between someone, you know, sitting in a room and dreaming of better times and wishing to be back home and to be able to bring them a bowl of soup that helps them relax, mm-hmm. that helps them heal, that helps them, you know, want to or think of family or a smell. Smells are another one. The food and taste and all those things are all intertwined. But, you know, for some people, the smell of seal is like, whoa, too much. And for others, seal makes their mouth water. It makes them think of home, or it reminds me of, them of camping with their family, or, you know, being at fish camp. And so, you know, just watching that over the years, there's so many different connections throughout it that are spiritual, that are mental health, that are really focused on not just your physical health, but your whole holistic being. And you see it time and time again.
Well, and it kind of harkens to that idea of the power of your own thinking, too, of your mind. You know, if you give up, your body's going to give up, too. But if if that nostalgia, that memory triggers hopefulness and happiness, that can go a long way to promoting you getting back on track and getting back to good health. Just the power of food, as our friend Nicole in Eagle River was talking about, her husband drinking this tea that helped his labs look better. And there are other types of tea I know that have a lot of medicinal benefits to help us. So I think that there's a lot of power in that thinking part of how this all comes together. Tara, what did you observe in your international work related to health and access to food? Talk a little about what did you see when people were able to eat locally versus subsidized or government food programs, and how they fared.
Mm-hmm. Well, I I think, first of all, of the joy of doing your sort of daily shopping in a place like rural Malawi. We lived in Naino, which was a community off the road system across a river with no bridge and, you know, not very many vehicles and everybody sort of on foot. And to procure your daily food was just to go to the open air market and to walk around and gather tomatoes and onions. And we had an avocado tree in our backyard, and mango season was this plentiful, beautiful, you know, pile of mangoes. And you knew the food producers. I knew them by name. When I got pregnant in Malawi, people were so delighted. They would cheer for me, the women that were selling tomatoes, and then hoist tomatoes on me, like, oh, you know, she's pregnant. We've got to feed her. We want her to be healthy. And it just felt so joyful and so deeply connected. You know, and I noticed that shopping directly from our farmers in America has become something that we have some distance from. You know, we sometimes think of it as a little bit of a bougie sort of wealthy middle class activity to have time to stop and go to a farmer's market in the middle of a Wednesday or spend your Saturday morning meeting your farmers. But in the places I've lived in Southern Africa, that's just not the case at all. You know, when you have a little bit more money and are able to go to the indoor grocery store, then you have access to the processed food. And I think at first that's a bit of a relief, maybe like it was for us in the 1950s when you could have a can of soup instead of making something from scratch the way Amy was describing. You know, maybe there's the time saving, maybe there's the ease. Of course, there's the sort of sugar component that creates a bit of an addiction. But, you know, you see a migration to chronic disease burden in places where there wasn't. You know, you see diabetes, you see the risk of stroke and heart disease when processed foods become more readily available. And I'll say one more thing, which is that I remember in my first couple of days of public health school, just the light going off when one of our professors talked about the structural ways in which our choices are made, and that you go into the grocery store, if the Twinkies are cheaper and they're at eye level and they're in the checkout line, you're probably going to end up buying them. But if that same thing was an apple, you probably would buy that. And that we're sort of like in the background of the way we think we're making active choices. We are influenced. And then what our kids have access to, I'm just shocked as a parent by how much candy my children come home with. It is like for everything that they do well or don't do well, they get rewarded. With, you know, bars and candy and things. And I don't say no to that. I don't want to run a household where people feel they can't eat something that they're interested in. But I do want to have it feel nourishing to eat from our garden, to go to the market, to know what it feels like to fish and to have a plant-based whole food, you know, basis to the diet where they've seen a Brussels sprout on a stalk and they aren't just familiar with that in a can that tastes kind of like my grandmother's house in the 1970s.
You know, when you were talking earlier about going from a time when all food was prepared at home or grown at home to then the convenience of a can of soup. And the power of the advertising that was behind all of that, mm-hmm. that told us, well, if you're a modern person, you're not mm-hmm. going to make that by yourself. Why would you do that? You could spend that time doing all kinds of other wonderful things. Here's a can of soup. Just eat that and you'll be fine. And it's interesting to see us sort of shifting back mm-hmm. to that realization of, there's a lot of benefit in eating locally, growing your own food, and also just the all of the energy that goes into it. We were cutting firewood over the weekend and splitting it up, and I was thinking about that old expression that people who burn firewood are warm twice, because you're warmed when you're putting it all, getting it all, and then you're warmed when you're burning it in your stove. So we are going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion as Food as Medicine on Line One, Your Health Connection. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is food as medicine. I'm your guest host, Lori Townsend, and our guests in the studio today are Tara Lloyd, Executive Director of the Alaska Farmers Market Association, and Amy Foote, Director of Indigenous Cuisine and Executive Chef for NANA Management Services. Amy, I worked for a tribal station in the lower 48 decades ago that was on a reservation. There were a lot of jokes about commodity food, cans of processed meat, white flour, blocks of kind of cheese, cooking oil. These were the staples. People joked about the low quality government food, but the clear effects on health were certainly no joke. Where did you first see the benefits of helping people get the food of their region rather than shelf stable commodities?
Wow, I think think it started long before I actually identified it, you know, as I look back throughout, I think, my life and my career. But when I started coming up to Alaska, I think I was 15, and I worked summers in Prince William Sound, and I really saw the benefits of, you know, folks just being out. I lived kind of in a on an island in the middle of the ocean there, but you know, a lot of the folks that we interacted with out at the island were really, you know, focused on harvesting their own fish or, you know, their own berries or their own medicines. You know, like we had heard about Nicole and the goldenrod. We heard lots of other different plants that were available. And so I think that's where I really started kind of learning and identifying that this was the thing, that this was you know, really part of our world. I think when the time I spent in Montana, I did see a lot of that as well. But really deep in the roots and working with elders up in the state. And so being in Alaska and really interacting with Alaska Native people throughout the state, and that real true connection with the surroundings and the food.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about the traditional foods program that you started at ANMC and how you're kind of carrying that work forward now at NANA.
Yeah, so in 2014 we started, you know, that's when finally some legislature went through as the Farm Bill. It's actually now U.S. code for us to be able to serve traditional and indigenous ingredients in kind of those more institutional settings. And that was the barrier when you're looking at immune compromised folks. We have to be a little bit more, not more, but just very focused on food safety. And somehow we look at a case of chicken that's delivered from a vendor that comes in frozen as safer than a moose leg that you just harvested and brought in from,
isn't that something? Yeah.
And it is. It's a fear. And so there's the food safety kind of piece of that. And so safety was a big space of what we did, and we developed policy and procedures, and it really was a comfortability and an understanding. Within those guidelines, you know, there's a lot of things like, you know, you can't take processed, right? So once something starts to become processed, then there's this opportunity for bacteria growth. So we can't serve smoke things unless we smoke them ourselves or we have them go through a commercial permitted process for that. And that goes for anybody. It's not just, you know, the program that, you know, we started at ANMC. It's, there's several other programs. Manilik has a hunters supported program in Kotzebue, and they do some really amazing things. They did a seal oil task force, and so they're able to actually, with a variance from the state, serve seal oil to their elders there. And that was really just understanding kind of marrying these traditional and indigenous ways of doing things to these modern or kind of restrictive guidelines and trying to find that happy medium in between. I always say that, you know, if you go by 100% health code of things, blue cheese is mold. And so, you know, right? It's a violation, right? I actually have a funny story from years ago where I ran into a situation with that. And it was just an interpretation, right? And with public health regulatory. And I thought, wow, this is just amazing to me. You know, here I am as a young chef, and they're saying this blue cheese is moldy and you can't serve it. I'm like, well, I bought it moldy. Like, that's how it came in, you know. But and so it's
that's
the same.
It's blue.
Yeah, exactly. And so all joking aside, the food safety part of what we do is really important. So making sure that we understand kind of the wellness of an animal or a fish. And that's why some of those guidelines are in place as it goes throughout. And so just carrying that work on to where it can really, you know, not just support one building, but support many programs throughout the state. And like I said, you know, wanting to incorporate indigenous and less processed foods into school districts. So that's a definite passion of mine. Serve on the school nutrition working group for the AFPC, which is a really great group. And really just looking at, you know, what we can do to work with local vendors in the state on that end of things, supporting, again, like I said, the Pioneer Homes or those long-term care, do a lot of work of just trying to help people set up policy. It's fearful. It can be a scary thing. And so two things, I think cooking is scary, and I think food safety gets scary for people if it's not something that you've really learned. So those are two ways that I really try to make it, you know, get your hands dirty. It's not so scary.
Yeah. I mean, food, especially food preservation, you want to be very careful about, you know, clean jars and sterilization and all those things and pressure cooking. And I mean, that is serious business to make sure that your food is safe when you open it later in the wintertime. Our rule always was you can't open a jar until the first snow flies. So we would put things in jars in the fall. I still do. And then you have to wait till the snow flies. But I wanted to ask one follow-up question before I move back to Tara here. When you mention the variants, does that allow you to actually bring in a moose leg if somebody wants to donate? Can you use wild foods like that in that hospital setting, or could you when you were at ANMC? And so is there's a variance so that they don't have to go through some sort of USDA meat processing facility?
So they can't be sold. So it's not like you could open up your restaurant and be like, hey, everybody, bring me your moose or your ptarmigan or whatever, right? Those kind of things. It's really specifically focused on institutional, and it is obviously tribal for it to be an indigenous foods program on that space of things. We had many. I've in fact, I think this year I've helped butcher or process four seals that we've had donated through our program, which is really amazing. So so we're serving, you know, seal on that end of things. I think that there's, you know, we saw just so many deer and moose and berries and plants and things like that. But when you look from the, so the variance that I was talking about was, you know, this is in place, but because seal oil requires a processing, and because there have been incidences of botulism, then that's where that sort of task force came into place. And so the variance, when I was talking about that, was really them going through and showing that there was a safe way to produce seal oil and to be able to serve it to the folks at the long-term care. And it was really a passion project from Cyrus Harris, and he's retired now, but he always said he was, you know, working on and getting that program as he was going to be an elder someday, and he wants to have his own foods then as well.
That was smart. He was setting it up for himself.
Yeah, and he's an amazing hunter and a big part of the community up there, and can't share enough of every time I talk to him. I feel like I learned something that I didn't know. But the work that so that was the variance I was talking about. The actual, you know, there's a federal guidelines. The state of Alaska has adopted those. Vice versa, we had it first. The federal guidelines came into place, and ours are all in alignment. And then the municipality of Anchorage also has their food safety guidelines that address the use of traditional indigenous foods.
Lots of layers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the regulatory.
Tara, getting back to you now, talk about what you've seen in especially the growth of smaller scale farms in Alaska. I grew up in Midwestern dairy farming families on both sides of my lineage, and those were hundreds of acres operations. But I know that there's kind of a proliferation of much smaller scale farms here in the state that is really fascinating. And then talk about what the nutritional advantage to food that is harvested at an optimal time is compared to food that is being shipped, you know, thousands of miles, half ripe or not ripe at all.
Mm-hmm. Liquid lettuce, as we call it, when it's gone through three rounds of sitting on the tarmac before it's delivered to school
liquid
lunch. And then you
lettuce,
think, why don't these kids like liquid lettuce?
Well, yeah, let's see. I guess I would begin by what an inspirational community I think the farming community in Alaska is. I, too, Lori, grew up in, you know, the eastern Kentucky, where large farms are more the norm, or farming is just seems like such a like long-lived institution. You don't think much about it. But here it really is such an endeavor, like such hardy people out growing in our short growing season, our vibrant sun, you know, growing the world's largest cabbage. But before I took the job, I didn't really know that much about it. I hadn't thought that much about what it looks like to farm in Alaska. And the USDA counts 1,173 farms in the state. And we lead the nation in the proportion of female farmers. So 48% of our farmers are women. And many of them, and many of our farmers in general, farm on less than an acre. They are making a living on a third an acre, a fourth an acre, maybe 2 or 3 acres. But small holdings, regenerative farming, diversified crops, you know, moving crops through a quick cycle, taking really good care of their soil. We don't have an organic certifier up here, so people don't typically have that certification, but many of them practice in those ways. Inputs are very expensive here, of course, like, you know, bringing in fertilizer and things from far away, but you can partner with the kelp farms and you can partner with all of the other richness in the Alaska food system and have inputs. You can have great compost programs. So people, they take good care of their soil, they make the most of the land they have, and primarily they're growing food for their communities. I think of these women out there from dawn to dusk, which, you know, this time of year means I don't know if they sleep, growing food for their neighbors. And we also have a really large proportion of young, new and beginning farmers, we call it. We don't mean that young in age, in years, but less than 10 years of growing experience. Mm. So that's another place that Alaska leads the nation, that proportion. We talk a lot about the graying of the fleet. You know, the farmers are aging out. Is there a succession plan in these like lower 4,800-acre farms? And here we really have a lot of young people coming in and either starting for first time or taking up their family farms. Of course, there's the history of the colony farms out in Palmer. I had some hesitation about taking the job because I thought I don't really understand the relationship of that farming ecosystem with the traditional and indigenous foodways and want to be very respectful of that. But I've learned throughout meeting the farmers that really everyone's on the same side of the table in Alaska in a way that feels so hopeful to me. Like people very connected to their food systems, the way you're describing, like people in their gardens and in their food provisioning and sharing their canned goods. But then the farming community feels very unified. And I count the indigenous agriculture groups in that. In that definition, and it feels like everyone wants the same thing, which is Alaskans able to feed Alaska.
What do you think food production could look like in Alaska in the next decade with that backdrop of, you know, young people coming here? It was interesting to hear you talking about that because I was thinking about, well, in the 70s, young people came here to work on the pipeline. Now young people are coming here to farm. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I like that idea a lot of adding to food security here. Do you think that Alaska can produce enough to put a meaningful dent in the volume of food that we import?
Well, I don't think we can if we can't try, if we don't start, you know. I think it can feel really intimidating, but I do believe that it is possible, and I think that looks perhaps incremental. Right now, we bring in 95% of our food. We import it along very precarious supply chains. If anybody has seen empty grocery shelves or worried about the port of Anchorage or whether the barge shipments are going to make it all the way, you know, I think we know that feeling in Alaska a little bit more intimately than other parts of the country. So 5% of our food being grown locally is not a lot, but it's something and it's meaningful. And I think as we can increase that percentage by percentage point, we can really see a transformation. And it kind of takes everybody. It takes the customers acknowledging the effort of our farmers and making it to the markets, the farmers markets. It takes food equity programs, making it affordable for those that are not able to shop at the markets without some subsidy. And of course, it takes the farmers being able to actually get out there and do the work and have that be respected. So some of it is like, what are our structural supports for them? Do they have health insurance? Are they living at the margin? Can they afford what they need for their families? Or is it such a tight margin that it's really hard to stay in it? So those are like sort of policy concerns. But then when I think about where funding is coming to Alaska, that's where food as medicine gets me really excited because
I think if our farmers are at the table as we plan to integrate food into systems that are Medicaid-funded, that are funded by the Rural Health Transformation Program, if there is big money coming to Alaska about our chronic disease burden or about our eating, you know, habits, then the farmers should be helping to design those interventions. And they could grow for prescription produce programs if they knew that there was going to be the demand and it would be sustained. You know, I think farmers, they can't be asked at the last minute. They have to be invited to the table in time to plan for this year's crops and to know what they're harvesting and what they're going to sell versus donate versus support in a prescription produce program. But if they are there, I mean, many of them could grow more food than they're growing. And there could be more farmers, as you're saying. And they don't have to come from outside. Some of them are, of course, just like our kids growing up now, but having the sense of like what is possible and what it means to grow food.
And Amy, you were talking about the layers of regulatory oversight, state, local, federal. Was it difficult to get that wild food into the hospital setting? And do you see a way of expanding that so that, as Amy was talking about, as Tara was talking about, expanding that so that there's a professional food service to help rural hunters and fishermen and plant and berry harvesters, kind of a path to small rural businesses that can maybe sell reindeer or moose to consumers or stores. Do you see that maybe, as Tara was saying, maybe part of this rural health transformation funding should be directed at how do we make sure that the food people are getting in the state is the best and healthiest food that they can have so that they are healthier?
Yeah, there's so much conversation, I think, that does go on, especially, you said reindeer, specifically around reindeer. There's a lot of ongoing, I think, kind of barriers with that. Some of it is just the basic infrastructure within our state to be able to process and to store. And to, again, even if we're doing things within our state, say, you know, we are able to raise enough reindeer to put on all the schools' menus for the entire state for the year. Like, we're able to do that. I think that the ability to raise reindeer and probably not process it, right, with the specific guidelines that we need. So there's some issues with infrastructure there. There's the, as we hear all the time, transportation, storage, all those things kind of, those layers, just as you go through, you find there's a lot of barriers throughout the state. And it's nothing different than what we see even just with purchased food, right? So I think that there's need for infrastructure. I have a colleague that jokes with me that infrastructure is my favorite word. And so whenever I say it, he's like, oh, tell us more. But it's true. And I think it's a very big, you know, maybe punchline, but it is a big issue within our state that we see all the way around for food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is food as medicine. And we are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is food as medicine. I just love that idea. I'm Lori Townsend. I'm the fill-in host today. I'm not a doctor. I'm a journalist. But I love this topic because I've been someone who has grown food and hunted and fished all my life and really believe in the benefit, the holistic benefit of everything that starts from getting seeds and working up the soil and getting out in the forest to harvest plants. I love all of it, and I know how much it contributes to my own well-being, and I encourage others to engage in those activities as well. Our guests today are Tara Lloyd. Tara is Executive Director of the Alaska Farmers Market Association, and Amy Foote is the Director of Indigenous Cuisine and Executive Chef at NANA Management Services. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Kelly is in Fairbanks. Hello, Kelly.
Hey, good afternoon or morning, everyone. Yeah, I'm a local farmer here in Fairbanks, so the schools and restaurants and individuals, and I just wanted to comment about like the food as medicine program, and from like a native tribal sovereignty perspective. I am originally from Hooper Bay, the Bohiyaw community, and And yeah, it's like we understand that maybe 70, 65% or 70% of all tribal members live in urban areas. So like kind of discussing about trying to get food as medicine to those people. But then when you look at people out in villages, it's like, I don't know, 100, maybe half the villages, you know, it's like 227 tribes in Alaska. Maybe about half of them don't get salmon. And a lot of it is for these structural systems that are in place that are extracting the salmon in large numbers and exporting it. So like last year, there was about 200 million salmon harvested and sold out of state. And we estimate that maybe about 0.5% of that number is harvested by subsistence users of Alaska. And so, like, kind of just, like, bringing, like, this whole community awareness of what's going on. Why do we talk about food as medicine? Why are we trying to get these foods into these systems? It's because, like, we have these two different cultures that are in place, circumpolar tribal nations. Their traditional cultural ways is to redistribute this meat through potlatches or gatherings, and where everyone would come in, these large harvests would be distributed through everyone. Everyone would get meat. Right now, we have a state that is making, that is stopping people from doing this traditional harvesting through putting a cap on how much food you could harvest. So young men can't do traditional gathering, go out and harvest a lot of meat, give to elders, people, mothers who don't go out and get this food, or even people who don't have enough money. Mm. And so we have like this full structure that is marginalizing what it means for young men to be leaders, just people part of their community. And so they're like being criminalized for this. And so it's like the food as medicine is super important, but we also have to understand these huge systems that are in play that are, you know, stopping this food from being distributed in this traditional manner. And let's not even, like, I'm not even talking about trawl, you know, that's probably emptied 60% of the pollock biomass out of the ocean.
Well, Kelly, you raise a lot of really important points and a lot to think about and consider. And I really appreciate your perspective. So important to be thinking about younger people and how they see their future and what they're allowed to do within the structure of state and federal regulations that, you know, thousands of years ago weren't in place, but they are now. And so it's a structure that creates some rigidity that people generationally didn't have. And so it does change things for the future. I did want to ask about, there's nothing that, you know, we can do in this discussion about state and federal regulations, but I wanted to ask about, in service to that idea, as food as medicine, and thinking holistically about that and how that could lead to potential change in the future also. Tara, you had mentioned during the break that there is a Food as Medicine Coalition. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's something that I'm really proud to be a part of, and perhaps our caller Kelly would be interested as well. This is a statewide invitation to folks to join a coalition that started 1 year ago. There's funding from the CDC through our state health department, the Physical Activity and Nutrition Unit, and they awarded the contract to run this 10-year program to the Food Bank of Alaska. So Rachel Miller, who's the chief advocacy officer there, runs the coalition, and it has representation from indigenous groups, from public health groups, from nonprofits, from farmers, from the Alaska Food Policy Council that Amy's on the board of. And basically, together, we're trying to Alaskify this concept, you know, to say, okay, if we know that putting food into sort of circulation, healthy, nutritious food through medical programs, like through prescription produce programs, which I can talk more about if we have time, or nutrition incentive programs where at the point of sale, the food is cheaper because, you know, people were either enrolled in SNAP or WIC or senior benefits, or they were in some way able to designate themselves as food insecure. And so there was some kind of subsidy at play there. We have a market match program for SNAP through the farmers market that's an example of that. But those types of things are kind of, they're in like a nascent stage in Alaska, and the coalition is trying to bring all those programs together, not say there's a one-size-fits-all, like Norton Sound has to do what YKHC is doing, has to do what the Food Bank of Alaska is doing, not at all, just to gather everyone and say, what are we doing and how are we sustaining the funding? How can we make sure it's not just kind of a one-off grant that was funded but then wasn't, or if our waiting lists are long for a prescription produce box for someone who's like at risk for chronic disease, how do we meet that entire list and not just say like, well, you know, we were kind of out of funding for now for something that seemed like it was working. So right now we have about 10 programs across the state of Alaska that are defined as one of those things I named, produce prescription or nutrition incentive program. But we think there are probably more. I mean, even though we did a landscape assessment and we tried to be as thorough as possible, we still hear of things that we haven't quite gotten into play yet. And so there's an invitation to folks to join the coalition. You would email FIM, food is medicine, at foodbankofalaska.org, or you could just pop on their website to learn about it. But it will be a 10-year endeavor that we're 1 year into, where we hope to really influence the kinds of things you've been asking about, Lori, like how the landscape of this shifts. And one thing I love about working in Alaska is just how hopeful it feels. It feels possible to make some of these changes in a way that, like, you know, in communities where, I don't know, 100-acre farms that are hundreds of year old, just it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of change. Here it feels like, you know, we have 750,000 people in Alaska. We could all get on board with with thinking right. about this differently.
And give that email address again. Was it F-I?
Uh-huh, F-I-M. Food is medicine. Yeah, okay. A verb food in that case, medicine. But either one works. Mm-hmm. But for the email address of the coalition, it's food is medicine, F-I-M, at foodbankofalaska.org.
Okay. I want to get to a quick email here because this is another way that people can promote their own individual food security. Daniel in Palmer writes, I have applied for this grant for several years and our family finally got a grant for a greenhouse for $5,000. We're putting one in this summer, and that's through the Department of Natural Resources. So there is a micro grant program for food security. And Daniel's pleased that his family was able to get one. And that's another way that people can look at how to promote food security for both their family and then neighbors and local folks as well. One of the things when you were talking about prescriptions for food, how do you both educate people to think differently about food? I read about a study of people who are diabetic or pre-diabetic. They were given food prescriptions. They could get $80 of fruits and vegetables for free every month, but they found that most people used far less than that. Do you think there's a way to shift Alaskans or all of us away from processed packaged food? It's convenient. It often has high levels of sugar and sodium. Do you think we're kind of essentially hooked on that, or is it more that many of us just don't have time for or know how to prepare fresh fruit and vegetables in a way that appeals to ourselves and our kids? Is that a part of the problem? It's just easier to grab something quick and provide that, even though it might not be as nutritionally beneficial as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear that all the time. People are like, wow, you always make, you know, look at your kid's lunch and look at this, you know. But cooking is something that is, you know, kind of just inherent obvious to me too as a chef, but even as a mom. And I think that I hear that a lot, you know, when you go and go to things, even just specifically with children, everything is you know, the Costco pack of whatever packaged item it is, because it's easy, right? It's shelf stable. It's all of those things. You know, sometimes fits within folks' budget, but I think going back and teaching, a lot of people don't know how to cook. They don't know how to prepare a vegetable. Just this last couple weeks, I just had this really funny thing happen with home. My 13-year-old says, Mom, I want to buy a juicer. just randomly, and he's saving up his money. And so we bought a juicer. He got it off Marketplace. And when I told the gentleman, you know, my 13-year-old's interested in your juicer, we're kind of wheeling and dealing. And I think he's like, hey, are you sure? So I pulled up and he went in and wheeled and dealed. And the guy was like, wow, it really was your son. I'm like, well, yeah. And so I don't know where this idea of wanting to, but he wanted to have his own fruits and vegetables and make his own juice. He's invested in it. So yesterday we went to go get this week's fruits and veggies that he wanted to do. And, you know, what I found was that it was like $75 that he, you know, by the time he's started, you know, I said, all right, well, now we're going to talk about budget and I'm going to give you $40. So you have to go back through. And you've got, this is what you have for this. But I think the exposure piece in that is really, you know, a lot of folks have never, I know a lot of kids especially haven't had different types of fruit and those mm-hmm. flavors. And so it's that early introduction. It's that, you know, teaching kids to, and adults, there's a lot of adults, there's kind of a generational gap in there, like you said, you know, of convenience and just, you know, kind of life. And then being in Alaska and having access that I think we need to go, personally, I feel like we need to go back and we need to really focus on teaching people that, you know, food doesn't have to be delivered to your door and, you know, in a bag from, right, Grubhub. Like, it doesn't have to come that way. Food can be something that you make at home. I think the preservation, like you had said, Loria, where there's this exchange, you know, I got lots of salmon, so I mm-hmm. smoked that and I shared my smoked salmon and maybe I bartered with you because you have an amazing raspberry patch or whatever that
can be. Yeah, I barter a lot of jam every year.
Yes, right? I don't purchase gifts for people. If you get a gift from me, it is always something that we have made, that we have harvested, whether it's a salve or a jam or a jelly or a jerky or smoked meats, those kind of things. But that's just how we choose to live. But I think there's a fear and there's a lack of just knowing how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the good news is that we are actually seeing the programs work. I know you cited a study, Lori, where perhaps it didn't, but the programs that are happening in Alaska, we have great data on. And we also have our recent study that the CDC put out that was a total of 50 programs that were looked at over the course of the last few years called the Social Determinants of Health Fruit and Vegetable Incentive Programs. And it actually did see meaningful change in terms of household food insecurity, intake of fruit and vegetables, blood glucose levels, where they were monitoring pre-diabetic patients. What we see out in like the Norton Sound Health Corporation or through the Food Bank of Alaska's program with the State Health Department is people excited about those boxes of food, using them, wait lists that are growing, people reporting, you know, meaningful change in their diets. And so I think it looks like some of what Amy's saying about the acceptability, making sure people know what to do with the food, having some choice in terms of what's coming. But there's a difference between a produce box that is prescribed that you might pick up already assembled and ready for you when you go in for your chemotherapy appointment or tied to some kind of recurring chronic disease appointment that you're going to have at the clinic. We see a lot of success with that because it's sort of like part of your program is to have this healthy food and here it is versus point of sale, which as you were describing means having to actually go and make those choices and use the vouchers. But at the farmer's market, we see wild success with that because we have chefs doing volunteer, you know, community meals, people coming together to eat the food that they're able to buy. We have programs for kids to get $10 for free when they walk in the market gate, and then they spend it buying things they're excited to try at home, and just trying to shift the tide on that that acceptability and really make it kind of a celebration of returning to the sort of nostalgia and customs and food being something we take the time and energy to really prepare and have be part of our lives. But it is a shift.
Well, and thinking back to what Kelly was saying about, you know, some of the difficulty in people being able to access certain types of foods because of regulations, and that sort of making the necessity of learning how to grow foods yourself as, you know, a supplement is so important. And I know that there's efforts all over in rural Alaska, too. Anaktuvik Pass, mm-hmm. There's... Rainy Hobson up there is growing in hoop houses, and and Seth Kantner in Kotzebue for many years. I don't know if Seth's still doing that. If he's listening, too late to call in now, Seth. But but for many years, Seth would go up the Kobuk River and help work up gardens and bring seedlings and help people start gardening projects there. Mm-hmm. So it's just this rippling out effect, I think, that will help us all have better health in the future.
Taking advantage of what we already know as a community. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was such a great discussion. Thanks to our guest today on Line One, Tara Lloyd, Executive Director of the Alaska Farmers Market Association, and Amy Foote, the Director of Indigenous Cuisine and Executive Chef with NANA Management Services. Thank you both for helping to promote good health for all Alaskans, and healthy people are happier people, and that's good for all of us. So thanks for that. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producer is Rachel Cassandra. I'm Lori Townsend. Line One will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.